Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Patty Ragland. My registration number is 22664, and I'm here on behalf of the injured worker. In this particular case, as you know from the file, Mr. Milroy is a fireman and has been in service in Colorado Springs since 1997 and continues to be a lieutenant for the city of Colorado Springs. He sought limited workers' compensation benefits based on an injury that occurred on April 11th, 2012 while working within the course and scope of his employment. He went to a fire alarm at a structure, and it was during the course of the events that evening in the response to the fire that he sustained these injuries. The key points that are on appeal, I believe, at this point is the errors of the administrative law judge in the process. First, the administrative law judge failed to record the hearing, and the only pieces, of course, that are missing were the first day, which was claimant's entire case in chief. Respondent's entire case was, of course, recorded at a later date, and so their record is maintained as part of the record on review. I believe that it is difficult, if not impossible, for there to be a review of the substantial evidence if, in fact, claimant's entire case is missing.
Well, why is that the case here, Ms. Ragland? You yourself made the motion to add the ALJ's hearing notes into the record, and you said specifically in your motion, which was stipulated by the other side, to preserve your client's case in chief. So we have the very detailed notes from the ALJ. I looked at them. We have over 200 pages of medical exhibits in the case. We have the party's position statements, which the ALJ in his ruling essentially cut and pasted yours. So I'm not sure where the prejudice is to you here. And you really don't say, I would be frustrated if I were you too. you didn't record my side. But there's a lot here. And if you went through the Appellate Rule 10C process to recreate the record, you probably would have been exactly where you are today. And I'm not sure there's much dispute on what your witnesses said. And so I guess I'm having trouble understanding the prejudice. The Knoll case says, you know, we grant a new trial under fairly unique, you know, rare circumstances. We have to decide if we can't review it. You haven't pointed out anything in the ALJ's notes that, you know, something missing from your side's testimony. You haven't said in the ALJ's notes anything that was wrong. And so I'm not sure what the prejudice is and why we can't review it. And I'm going to stop talking in a second and let you respond. But you also say that you couldn't have done a 10C process because the ALJ retired. I guess I don't understand that. Why not? I mean, the number one, you both may have stipulated to the facts, and the new ALJ will say, blessed. Or if you had a dispute, the new ALJ had the old ALJ's notes and could have ruled. So could you address all those record issues? I guess all of it goes to, why are you prejudiced here?
In 30 seconds or less.
I'm not sure I can do it in 30 seconds or less, Your Honor, but I certainly try to address all of those issues. And specifically, there are errors from the ALJ's notes. And, Your Honor, because there is this dual track that goes on in the process with an expedited basis, it made it impossible for us to complete the CAR 10 process because, in fact, if you carefully review the stipulation that was entered, the ALJ's notes was the first piece of recreation of the records, but we were prohibited from completion of that process in order to come to the statements of evidence that claimant would have been able to make at that process, because in fact the clerk then inserted herself into the process, and the clerk declared that the ALJ notes was sufficient for the transcript, when in fact claimant hadn't even received the ALJ notes until the day before the clerk decided that the ALJ notes were sufficient. So claimant didn't even have an opportunity to go through the process of then proceeding to explain all of the deficiencies. In fact, there's a very careful reading of the record will demonstrate that the ALJ indicated that there was no pain in claimant's leg, noted, however, there was some discussion of that at length during claimant's testimony. And if you'll note, there is an exhibit within the record, and I believe it's claimant's exhibit 21, which is at record page 86. There are specific notes regarding the discomfort felt by claimant down the leg, which is of course notable for the herniation to have occurred at that particular time. And without the testimony of the claimant, we have nothing to go on with respect to his explanation in furtherance of this Exhibit 21, and indeed, we also are missing Dr. Kleinbart's explanation of the axial load process that occurs within the spine as you come down the pole from a sleeping position and then rush off and put on all this bunking material, these bunkers, as they call them, which is the gear, essentially, in the awkward positions that the firemen have to do, you know, in the process of returning it. And I believe that there is also some indication of that within the record that you will see in claimant's position statement at page 296. The problem is the position statements had to be filed in this process before the ALJ notes were completed, which was the first step in recreating the record. And so I believe that ICAP has assumed that the position statement is therefore sufficient. But until we had the record, the first step of the record, which was the ALJ notes, we were incapable of being able to put the statement of the evidence in. And that is a different document that would be created in a different method than a position statement.
Did you ever, is there any pleading below where you said you were denied this, that the ALJ's notes were not complete, things were missing? The argument that you just made to me now, I have to say, and I of course read all the briefs, I don't remember it even being in your brief, the way you just, you make general statements about things missing, but you don't articulate what, I don't think. And again, I've read the briefs a little while ago, so I may not be remembering, and if I'm not, I apologize. So I guess, did you argue this below, that you were denied the opportunity to complete the record, you really need the opportunity? I mean, I didn't even see any effort below where you made a motion to say, you know, we need to, now that we have the notes, we need another shot here to make a record.
Your Honor, that was argued, and if you give me a moment, I believe that I can... I believe if you look at the opening brief at pages 5 and pages 6, there is some discussion at that point that the testimony was missing from Dr. Kleinbart's, as well as discussing the missing portion of claimant's testimony. So I do believe that that was argued below. The problem really comes with the clerk asserting that the ALJ notes are sufficient when in fact we have this pending order from the judge saying that we're going to be able to have the extra 10 days to insert this additional information in the record.
Well, counsel, let me ask you a little bit about that if I could. I was trying to put together a timeline too, and I may have it wrong so you can correct me, but it looks like the order said you would have 10 days. The decision came out on day 12 afterwards, and that so the significance being that you don't make an objection until after you've had a chance to read the court's findings of facts and conclusions of law. Is that timeline not correct?
Actually, the timeline I think is probably best put forth in petitioner's reply brief. I've done kind of a chart in that particular brief, and I think that to respond precisely to what you're looking for, Judge, or Your Honor, is that the position statements were done on July 22nd, and then we have the stipulation from the ALJ completed also on the 22nd of July. We have the order regarding the stipulation done on the 30th of July, 2013. The petition to review is then done on August the 29th. And the letter from the clerk, a letter exists within the record from me indicating that I still don't have the ALJ notes at that point on August the 30th. The receipt of the notes from the ALJ actually occurs on the 7th of October, which is what then triggers the commencement of the 10 days, arguably, pursuant to the stipulation that we have and pursuant to CAR 10. However, then on the 8th of October, the clerk enters the order saying, no, you don't get to do this because we're going to consider the ALJ notes sufficient. And so at that point, jurisdiction is gone, and there is no method by which to complete the CAR 10 because the clerk has declared otherwise.
Okay, thank you.
Well, let me just make one clear, so I again understand the facts. It's a little difficult, I think. The letter you wrote about you never, that you didn't have the ALJ's notes until whatever you said it was, and I apologize, I don't remember the exact date, was in response to your colleague's motion to supplement the record. And that motion was denied. I mean, they say you got the notes in July, you said you got them later. None of that ultimately got in the appellate record because the motion to supplement was denied. So we have, I'm just, and this is a question, not a statement. I think we have your, in response to his motion to supplement, you say, no, I didn't get him till later, but we don't have really anything else in the record, true?
No, Your Honor. Actually, if you would look at the record at record page 333, I believe that you will find a letter that's in the record that had nothing to do with that motion that is actually from me to the Office of Administrative Courts, and that is dated August the 30th, indicating that I still don't have the ALJ notes. So the assertion that they were done in July, it wouldn't make sense for this letter to have then appeared and be in the record on August the 30th, 2013.
All right, so that, I mean, what we have, and just what's in the record, and I promise I looked through it, is that letter saying as of August 30, we know you, at least you say you didn't have them. That's in the record as of the relevant time. The dispute over July versus October, that's not in the record, correct? He says you got him in July. I think you said you ultimately got him in October. None of that is in the record.
True. The only thing that's in there, Your Honor, is the letter at the end of August
that's
saying
I
don't have it.
Thank you for helping.
Counsel, you've been asked a lot of questions, but I'm afraid I have to ask you one specific.
No problem.
The standard that we are to apply is the substantial evidence standard in looking at the supportability of the ALJ's ruling, correct?
I agree that is to some degree the standard that needs to be done. I believe there are two pieces to this process, and I believe that we have the compliance of the CAR 10 and our ability to appropriately have a record for the substantial evidence review to have occurred.
Okay, well, here's my question. The test is, as I understand it, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that substantial evidence is probative evidence that would warrant a reasonable person to believe in the existence of facts supporting the ALJ's findings without regard to contradictory evidence in the record. Does that sound about right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so our task is to look and see if the ALJ's ruling in this case is supported not by your evidence, but by the respondent's evidence, by the evidence in the record that's there. And so my question is, I understand the problem with the record, but aren't we supposed to just look at whether the ALJ's ruling is supported by the evidence that your opponent put in? And if it is, isn't that the end of our inquiry?
If the inquiry is going to be specifically limited, as you're suggesting, Your Honor, then in that circumstance, I think you have to look at whether the judge also applied the appropriate standard for review. And there are different standards for an occupational disease versus an injury. And I think that in this particular circumstance, the judge has kind of overlapped the analysis of the two without making an appropriate separate distinction between those two standards. And therefore, the order can't stand on its own based on that.
But the courts or the ALJ, I think, specifically said I don't find evidence of an actual injury occurring on a specific date. And I don't find any evidence of an occupational disease, right? So isn't it supportable on either ground?
Well, in fairness, Your Honor, I think it would be difficult to find that if you don't have the record or can't recall the record with respect to the injury that occurred, and that the only portion of the record that is there is in error, clearly by the record that is left, which is the exhibit that I mentioned earlier, the exhibit 21, I believe. I apologize, I don't know that off the top of
my
head.
Thank you. We're going to give you a little more time, Ms. Ragland. We've asked you a lot of questions. If you have some more to present, you can present it on rebuttal, or if you'd like to conclude now, or if you'd like to continue, we'll give you a couple minutes.
I'd like to save my last few minutes, if I may. for rebuttal.
All right, we'll give you 2 minutes, clerk.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel.
Your Honor, should I have both sides 2 minutes?
Let's just stick with two for Ms. Ragland at this point. We'll see how much questioning we have for counsel for the response.
Thank you. Good morning, judges. My name is Greg Chambers, registration number 14028. I'm representing the city of Colorado Springs. The Industrial Claim Appeals Office did not retain representation for this brief, so, or this appeal, so I guess I'm handling both sides. I don't have a lot to say. You've identified, based on the questions that you've posed to council, you've identified why I believe the record is sufficient for appellate review. In terms of the fact that the hearing was not recorded and therefore there was no transcript, that's not a basis for a de novo hearing. It's clear that the judge heard the testimony. It's clear that the judge had hearing notes that documented what he heard. In most workers' compensation cases, most hearings, judges do not have the benefit of an audio recording or a transcript when they issue the order. They base it on the recollection. The judge is basing it on the recollection of the testimony they heard, plus the notes they have to help them with the recollection. And then, as identified by this court, a review of all the submissions that the parties had submitted, the medical records, the employment records. In this case, we had an evidentiary deposition of Dr. Elizabeth Bisgard, who was the city's expert. She provided her opinions as to why this was not a compensable occupational disease and or injury. And then based on all that records, then position statements are filed. And as is conceded by claimant in his brief on page 20, provided the claimant an opportunity to identify in great detail the evidence that he wanted the judge to consider in reaching his decision. He considered it. He considered the entire record, and based on the entire record, ruled for the respondent, for the city, and against the claimant. There is no allegation that the judge did not hear the testimony or that he didn't take hearing notes. There is now, I was going to argue, and I'm still going to argue this. There is no indication, let me back up. The hearing notes, when do the hearing notes show up? As mentioned earlier, I filed a motion to supplement the record because when I got the record from the Court of Appeals for the first time, I noticed that the email that was sent out to the parties on July 25, 2013 was not part of the record. So I was kind of going crazy. Why is the ICAP saying that my waiver argument wasn't good? Because I remember, I had the email. But be that as it may, that motion to supplement was denied. To the extent that I can ask you to reconsider it, I would. But I don't think it's important to your analysis, because at the ICAP level, the notes were available. At this level, the notes were available. And I agree, there is no specific reference to an error or omission in the hearing notes. So the judge's hearing notes reflect what he considered in reaching his decision, including the testimony that was given at the hearing. The position statements filed by the parties also identify what was said at the hearing, what the testimony was at the hearing. As it turns out, the judge relied much more on medical records and the transcript of the deposition taken of respondent's medical expert, plus chronology that the claimant himself completed and submitted as documentary evidence as to the sequence of events that occurred. He relied on all of that and came to his decision. And just touching on the substantial evidence rule, I totally agree. If substantial evidence supports the ALJ's finding, they must be upheld. And that's true even if substantial evidence supports a contrary finding. So if the transcript, and say the transcript has nothing but favorable evidence for the claimant, you know, I was there, I cross-examined, so I got to think that there was something, you know, that I contributed, so it's not totally inflammatory, but even if it was.
So even if you were ineffective?
Even if...
You opened the door, Counselor.
Apparently it didn't. This is now going to be a public record. Thank you, Judge. Even if I was incompetent, ineffective, even if I was a lump in a chair, and everything was favorable for the claimant, unless there is an allegation that, A, the judge didn't hear the testimony, and he didn't take hearing notes, and the hearing notes do contain errors and omissions, that's it. There's still substantial evidence that supports the ALJ's finding. It may not be necessarily in the hearing transcript, but it doesn't have to be. It can be anywhere else. So that's kind of where I am. I have nothing. It looks like you're about ready to ask.
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious. One thing that was a little concerning to me in the ALJ's order, the ALJ doesn't, it would have been helpful, with, you know, with all due respect to ALJ friend, to have a specific finding rejecting the acute injury argument. I mean, he kind of does seem to focus more on the occupational disease when you get to the conclusions. There's no real direct statement that says, I don't find an acute injury here, so I'm going to look at occupational disease.
Yeah.
I mean, we do have an express finding that he finds Dr. Bisgard credible and Dr. Kleinbart less credible or less persuasive. I mean, is that where we find the rejection of the argument of acute injury? Is there something else in this order I'm missing?
The judge is not held to crystalline standards. And there's plenty of orders that I've received from judges over the years where I wish they would articulate a little bit better every issue that's been addressed. And that just doesn't necessarily happen. But that doesn't mean it's reversible error. Because if we look at if you want to identify substantial evidence on an acute injury, what you have is, in the hearing notes, what I argued in my position statement, claimant at the hearing never testified as to an acute injury, never said, I slid down the pole and that caused the injury. This was something that his expert rendered an opinion based on the testimony that the claimant gave. Dr. Bisgard, if you recall the record, Dr. Bisgard testified that when she met with the claimant and asked him specifically about this incident about sliding down the pole, her testimony was, claimant said, and it's an audio recording, it's not part of the record, but the audio recording says, it's not as if I slid down a pole and went, ouch. So to the extent that there is an implicit inferred finding or determination of an acute injury, the substantial evidence would support that. So that's kind of where I am. I wish the judge had been more articulate, but I don't think it rises to the level of reversible error.
So you just clarify, you're relying on to say the record supports no acute injury because the chronology that the claimant submitted shows he had some twinges on, you know, 11 days before. He saw all these doctors, all this in the record. He never said acute injury, and then the testimony you said, and that all your position supports no acute injury.
Correct. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Ragland, we're giving you a couple minutes.
And I would just give a little bit of information here to judge with respect to what the record provides. And the fact is that the record demonstrates, even through Dr. Bisgard's testimony, that she in fact says that there is a reasonableness and necessity to the care that was received on the night of the specific injury, the acute injury event, because he went from an individual who was sleeping comfortably that night and without pain, and the only events that took place during that evening was the slide down the pole, the response to the structure fire, and by the time he gets back to the firehouse, he and his fellow EMTs are convinced that his pain is so bad from those events that he has to go to the ER. Those events kind of speak for themselves, and they kind of encapsulate the idea that an individual may not be able to say, oh, there it is. But certainly, when the events surround only activities associated with the course and scope of the employment, and you start the activity and you end the activity, and when you end the activity, you are in a position of acute stress to the point of having to have an ER visit, certainly it speaks to itself in terms of when the event occurred.
Well, Ms. Reger, you speak of it being only, but I thought that the claimant had acknowledged that days prior to that, that he had been feeling some pain in the same areas that ended up being triggered on the night of the fire alarm.
Your Honor, that is essentially a red herring. That had all resolved by the time this had come up. He was back to full duty. He was doing what he always did. He had 39 chiropractic visits over a 13-year period. That comes down to 3 a year. It's not as if there had been, you know, some major event that had occurred before and this was lingering on into the events. This was a matter of this event took place during a structure fire, start to finish. In terms of when the pain actually commenced. The other thing I would speak to is that the lack of the transcript puts us in a position where we cannot demonstrate the error of the ALJ notes, because without the transcript, we can't show you where the errors are. And if the ALJ's notes are considered to be the only portion of the transcript, then how is claimant to demonstrate that the substantial evidence doesn't exist in support of it? Because there are errors in the record that need to be called the attention to, and I simply can't do it without appropriate completion of the record. And so we would ask for remand and rehearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course. That concludes.